Conference number 15, 10:45 a.m., September 26, 1985. Father Hugo.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Father, in restoring human nature through grace, you have given us a greater dignity than we had in the beginning. Keep us in your love and continue to sustain those who have received new life through baptism. We ask this through Christ the Lord. Now we'll continue on our this pledge I've given you. I'm not asking you to take the pledge. This is issued by these people. The Shakers, I guess. I don't know. I think some retreatant probably gave me that. Not quite sure where I got it. It has Mother Seton's name on there, a word by Mother Elizabeth Seton, so maybe a Catholic group sponsored this printing. I really don't know, but I think it's something we can acceptable. It's something we're talking about. The simplifying life. There's a great interest in this today. There's a recognition that we are pigs. We one-fourth of the human nation. We're a human race that's taking four-fifths of its resources, even from that point of view. And so there are books. There's one by a bishop, Bishop O'Reilly, he calls his book on it. It's an unlikely title, the King, something about Christ the King. But it means that he is the King of the universe, and that we should use the resources as stewards. So that they would, books like that would be good spiritual reading. But now we'll get back to our subject, because that's really what we're talking about here. Now, we've seen that there's a double relationship between nature and grace, a relationship of harmony and a relationship of conflict. We've been discussing the relationship of harmony. Now, this is theology. It may be dull and dry, and you might say, well, I'm not interested in theology, but you are. Remember what a theology is? It's faith seeking to understand. Whenever you take your own children and begin to try to explain to them the things of faith, you are getting your feet wet in theology. As soon as you take it out of the words of Scripture and try to put it in your own words, you have to find the appropriate words, and you have to find the appropriate thoughts, and you're in theology. You're ankle deep. As your children get older, you're going to get knee deep, or else you're going to neglect them and miss the boat yourself. And sometimes we get over our head, perhaps, but better to get a little too deep than not to realize what we're doing at all. And so that's the only apology I can make, that we are to honor God with our whole minds as well as our whole hearts. And it requires study. And I think that you should give the spiritual life some study. Remember the first three steps? Reading, study. Study is something we're losing today because of the media. We want everything in pictures. But there's some things that pictures can't show. They can't show us the truths of our faith, the abstract doctrines that underlie them, and we need study for this. And so we need to revive study of the spiritual life, not just looking at it, but studying it. People take courses in speed reading now so they can get through it without any effort. You see, that's not studying. If you want a book on reading, I would get Mortimer Adler's book on how to read a book. That's a little classic, how to read a book. He teaches you how to extract every ounce of juice out of any book you read, and that should be our ambition, to get any book that's worthwhile. I think we should have few books. I think you should be selective. Beware the man of one book. You don't have to read every book. Beware the man of one book means that if you read one book and read it well, why, you're likely to learn a great deal more than if you read a lot of books and read them superficially. And I would take a thing like Adler's, which I've done myself, and use it to analyze a book. So don't see how fast you can read a book, but how thoroughly you can read a book, how much you can get out of it. You haven't really read it until you extract from it what the author, perhaps through years of labor, has put into it. Okay. Now we're into theology, then. We've seen there are two ways in which there's harmony, according to the substance of nature and according to the natural activity. And yet, we already find a kind of a tension between nature and grace. Grace is pulling us away from our natural impulses, our natural desires. Now, there's a third way in which there is harmony between nature and grace, and that is in reason. Faith harmonizes with reason. Therefore, when we're asked to live a life of faith, we're not asked to do anything contrary to reason. We know this pretty well. You've been taught this, I think, in parochial schools. And that faith comes from God, and our reason comes from God, and therefore we can't expect to find any discord between them. And we find that reason agrees with faith. As I said, faith dwells in our intelligence. Faith illuminates reason. Faith illuminates reason. You see? And therefore, since faith does not destroy reason, we mortify nature, then doesn't mean to be irrational. Some people really think that to be good Christians, they have to engage in irrational conduct. They cultivate eccentricities, whether of manner or of gait or of food or whatever they do. They seem to think that to imitate Christ means to cultivate eccentricities. I don't think we should cultivate eccentricities. I don't think we should try in any way to be conspicuous. The good Christian will try to be inconspicuous. Anyway, we have enough eccentricities by nature without trying to develop more with the help of grace. I suppose everybody has a quota of eccentricities, but don't exceed that quota. And keep yourselves as inconspicuous as possible. So we're not recommending any eccentricities of manner, you know. And they don't show that you're a better Christian at all. They just show that you don't understand the nature of Christianity, which is a life of grace and interior faith and love. So we can take it for granted that there is no conflict between faith and reason. We all agree on that. Catholics generally know it. But there's one thing, aspect of it, that we don't generally know, and we need to attend to in living a practical Christian life, and that is this, that even though there is harmony between nature and grace, there is also tension between, faith and reason, there is also tension between faith and reason. Because faith calls us to do things that reason does not understand. And reason is imperious in its demand to understand. When Abraham, who's given to us as a model of faith, was called upon to leave his home and his prosperous business, agribusiness, and on the wild promise that he was going to be the father not only of a son, this childless old man, but that he'd be father of a great nation and of a great people, that was wild. And yet Abraham believed, and it was reckoned to him as justification. He was justified through faith, his faith in God. And he left his home with that hope. Even his wife, Sarah, couldn't take it. She couldn't follow him, at least at first. You know, whenever he was told he was going to have a son, we're told that Sarah laughed. Sarah, the wife of Abraham. She laughed. And that's why Isaac was given the name Isaac. That means laughter. See, it seemed ridiculous to Sarah. And by reason standards, it was. And yet we honor Abraham as the great leader of faith. That's why we keep his memory. He gives us a typical instance of faith, to do what seems foolish in the sight of men in order to obey the word of God. Now, this often happens. The saints do things that seem to be foolish, but we shouldn't seek them out, but faith draws us in. Faith drew the people we're reading about in this week, Maximum Cole and Martin Luther King, to do things. Martin Luther King was considered a madman. He was considered an anarchist. He was considered a bad citizen. He was following a divine inspiration that he could not resist, and he followed it faithfully, and he became the savior of his people. Dietrich von Bonhoeffer was following a divine inspiration against the opinion of all his fellow Lutheran clergymen and all his fellow Lutherans in Germany. Who is he to do this? But he did it. He followed it. He resisted. Franz Jägerstätter followed his inspiration against all the Catholics and the clergy in Germany from the beginning with a quiet persistence and a sureness. He simply would not be introduced into the Nazi militia. He refused, point blank. He would pay the price by being beheaded. But he paid the price, and he approached it with great tranquility. He was sure of himself. He was guided by God. And we meet others like that, that have a sense of divine mission, and it's pretty hard to deny it from the outside. This is why saints are distrusted. They do things which we can't, the institution can't approve of. What about Molly Rush, for example, here in Pittsburgh? Do people here, I guess for those of you outside of Pittsburgh, Molly Rush is a pacifist who has been part of many demonstrations and thrown into jail. She's the mother of, I forget how many children, I think five at least, and she has very courageously made her protest against the build-up of nuclear weapons, and not taking her family as a reason for not doing it. Her husband doesn't join her, but he apparently approves it. They're not separated. They're still together. And so, now what about a woman like that? Maybe you don't approve of what they did to bruise, but damage the nose cone of an airplane. It seems a trifling thing to do, and many people think it's foolish and useless. That's reason. And other people disapprove because it's illegal. And it's true that a man like Gandhi never did anything that was illegal. When he disobeyed the law, it was an unjust law that he disobeyed. But he wouldn't do a thing deliberately illegal, because then that draws questions on oneself, your own integrity, if you do things illegal. But, of course, they're protesting against what they think, which is vastly immoral, which has already been condemned by the Catholic Church. And so it's a little bit risky to judge their motivation. We may judge the meaning of their actions. We say, that's not prudent, or that's not this, or that's not that. But they're not worried about prudence. They are making their stand, their witness against a worldwide, a final catastrophe for the human race. And there's only a few voices raised up against it. We all go along with it because most of our men, our work people in this country, are making their living on making war weapons. We live in a war economy. We have lived in a war economy for 40 years. We deplore unemployment, and so do I, but much of our employment is in war industries or related industries, making the weapons that will destroy ourselves as well as others. But for the short gain and good wages, we will do that. You've seen, as I have on television, whenever a great firm here like the one in Pittsburgh based when the, I forget the name, whenever the employees get $1 billion contract for making weapons or airplanes, They scream and they cheer because they're back to work. See, that's the way we judge things. What's good for my pocketbook, good for me, is good for the world. So these other people, though, live by this faith, and they carry their faith to the limit. All these people we're reading about were crazy in the eyes of their own peers, their own family, their own equals. They were simply crazy people. They were crazy for God. That's the foolishness of the cross carried to a limit. So we have to be careful when we say that faith does not conflict with reason. It does conflict with reason. The truth of faith does not conflict with the truth of reason, but the truth of faith is often hidden from the eyes of reason. That's the mortification of living a life of faith. Faith does not give us the answers. It gives us duties, but it does not give us the answers of why. It doesn't answer the question why, and that's what our reason wants to know. And so this is part of what we need to know as Christians and Catholics too, that there is this tension, and we may be called, any of us, any time, to do something. It's pretty hard to set up your judgment against others. These people all have their own reasons of faith, and I don't think that they can be very well judged from outside. So here we have then three ways in which there is harmony between nature and grace. Three ways in which we find God in both orders, in the substance of nature, in the activity of nature, and in the reason which guides nature. And yet at the same time, we find a tension because of the fact that we have been raised to live in the order of grace, and natural inclinations are against that. I've already said, I gave you Bonhoeffer's edition of Original Sin, resistance to God. Nature resists that invasion. We want to be left alone with our reason and work things out our own way. And this is what faith asks us, to rise above this and to do things. We should make sure it's faith. There are many people have illusions and false visions and false raptures, and we can't trust them. There has to be some guarantee. And, of course, the best guarantee, I guess, is what Jesus gives. He gives the criterion, by your fruits you shall know them. An evil tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, and a good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit. By your fruits you shall know them. That's the criterion he gives us to judge whether a prophet is truly a prophet. Does it produce holiness? Does it produce goodness? Does it produce benefits to humanity, to the children of God? All these martyrs that we study today, the answer is yes. It did produce benefits. They gave their lives to produce those benefits, benefits which they could not enjoy themselves. And so they passed the test. But sometimes the test is not so easy to pass, and there are false prophets. This is one of the things we forget today, like when we're talking about spiritual reading. There are many false prophets with books out. They're interesting books. Jesus tells us that. He says, beware of you when you're praised by men. Such happened to their fathers. You see, woe to you when you were praised by men. Blessed are you when men persecute you and rejoice with you. You see, to be accepted by others is not a guarantee of rightness before God. To have a following like a Billy Graham does not mean that Billy Graham is really doing the work of God. If Jesus is correct and he's not, there's something wrong. He's never been persecuted at all. He said everything that was right. Nothing he says is displeasing to anybody. One of his own biographers has pointed that out, another minister. He's never made an enemy through what he's preached. He hasn't been crucified. Well, I only take him, and I don't want to judge him either, because he's a public figure and he's revealed himself so publicly. on the basis of this biographer, I would see he doesn't meet the criterion of Jesus, because Jesus does say, woe to you when men will bless you and say all that is good about you. Such they did to the false prophets. Blessed are you when men persecute you and do all that is evil, when they think they are blessed by God when they take your lives. Blessed are you, says Jesus. These are what he says to the men and these women of faith. You see. So this is really a complex matter. And not easy. Now we come then, I'd like to make a kind of a summary of this with two images. I would make a summary which will explain this tension between the inclinations of nature. Let's use that phrase instead of nature and grace. Let's say the inclinations are to be mortified, the impulses of nature. Nature is in no way to be damaged itself. Neither our reason, neither our activity, nor the substance of nature. None of this is to damage. We have not the right to damage it. We must use it for God. But if we mortify it, we mortify the impulses of nature, the inclinations of nature, the motives of nature. And that's exactly what this pledge of the Beatitudes there does. It helps you to mortify the inclinations of nature. I'm sure everyone here, you know, in their secret pagan heart, would like to be prosperous, enjoy all the fruits of prosperity, all the comforts of life. This is very natural to us indeed. So if you would follow a program like this, you would be mortifying nature, natural inclinations every day. You would say, no, I won't buy that. No, I won't eat that. No, I won't go there. No, I won't take that vacation. No, I won't take that trip. I'm going to take the proceeds of that, and I'm going to give it to the people who are starving now in Mexico or in Africa. I'm going to share with them. The tragedy today is, as we read the papers, is that we can't even do that. We find injustice and cheating in the delivery of the goods even to the poor. It's stolen on the way to them. But even so, we have to take the risk somewhere to help. So that's the reason why this is why we mortify nature, you see. That might not seem like much of a work today, but it is if we do it every day, if our whole lifestyle is curtailed by these mortification of our desires. See, whenever we mortify our desires, our inclinations, we're mortifying something that we have control of. This is the area of our freedom. We're not anyway hurting our nature or our natural activity. We're only hurting our own personal ambitions, our own personal vanity, our own personal hedonism, our own paganism. That's what we're hurting. Now let's go into the two examples that I want to give you to explain that. I almost forgot them again, and they're very good, I think. The first one is this one. Whenever, you know, you've seen pictures of cowboys breaking in horses, as they call it. The horse is a beautiful animal, fierce and powerful. And men have always wanted to use it for their work. But the wild horse is a fearsome beast, and it has to be tamed. And so we see these pictures. Maybe some of you have seen it in reality. Rodeo, which they break these horses. And then after the horse is broken in, why, it's used for commerce, for pulling wagons, you know, it used to be. And a child can ride them and guide them safely. I was reminded one time, however, by a retreatant, a woman who made the retreat, that breaking of horses is not the term which horse lovers or horse fanciers use. They speak of it as gentling the horse. A better term. Perhaps both terms can be used. that fierce strength of the horse must be broken, but not destroyed. It's going to be used now. It's going to be used in the service of men. Our ancestors used it, and it's still used in many parts of the world, and for that. So to gentle it. Now, that's what has to be done with our passions, with our appetites. Not destroyed, but gentled. And in order to be gentle, they have to be broken in the sense of being mortified. We must curtail them. We have a tendency in our day, this post-Freudian age, to think of all mortification as a inhibition, as a essential or substantial restriction on our activity. But we see that in order to use the horse, it has to be gentle. And it's the same with our passions. We need a discipline on them, or they will go wild, and they do, which we see in the crime rate, the murders, the rapes, all the sexual crimes, inventing new crimes and inventing new sexual diseases in our day, really going no discipline for our passions at all. Stealing, rife. We can only live a civilized society when these passions are disciplined. That's why we have laws, and that's why laws have to be enforced, sometimes with harshness, if we're to live in a civilized society. And so that to discipline our desires is not repression. It could be repression, but it's not necessarily repression or inhibition. It can be thought as disciplining, as I think I mentioned the other day. Even a man like Freud was a highly disciplined man, or he could not have written the books. An artist is a disciplined person. Did you ever see a piano concerto? A musician sitting down for 40 minutes and without a note in front of him to play one of these difficult concertos of a Mozart or a Beethoven or Chopin, and then turn around and play another one? Like a man like Arthur Rubinstein, who was doing it up until a couple of years ago at the age of 80. It's a tremendous feat of physical strength to do that. And the discipline to do that so accurately and so beautifully. So that all truly good and great human activity requires this kind of repression, if that's the name you want to give it. Paderewski, I read, even as a concert musician, was still playing the scales 8 hours a day in practice to keep that discipline, that perfection, that touch. And so it's fantastic, you see, to think of all personal discipline as repression or inhibition, without inhibitions of this sort. A ballet dancer, but we hardly see so beautiful they are and so graceful that a great ballet dancer is a real athlete, a perfected athlete with perfect muscular control, which only comes with constant exercise and discipline. And a discipline that includes their diet. A woman, the ballet dancer, has to be able to get nourishment on practically nothing in order to carry out her part in the ballet and to be handled by the male dancer as they are. So that's real discipline. They, for an earthly crown, they do it. So it's certainly wrong to think of all repression, and it's not good psychology. It's certainly not good scriptural psychology. It may be good Freud. I don't know how this is exaggerated in the case of Freud, but I say it's wrong. But we've accepted it all, that all discipline is inhibition, all is repression, and we just got to do what you want. It's been introduced into our educational system as don't discipline the child in any way. Don't suppress it. It's genius. It's creativity. Well, Mozart, probably the most disciplined musician that ever lived was Mozart. And yet he was wild in other ways. that he was a disciplined, and he had to accept that discipline to produce the work that he did. So that's one illustration. Another illustration is what we're watching in nature now. Maybe I don't know, we have an orchard down here beside us there, and the sisters sometimes bring apples up and put them on the table, they're very tasty sometimes, but also they have many imperfections on. I don't know whether they would trust them with you, because the trees are not taken care of. Basically, they're not pruned. There's a big difference between a fruit tree that is pruned carefully and one that is not pruned. The one that is not pruned will be spotty. The fruit will be sparse. It will be spotty, imperfect, defective, irregular. The pruned fruit tree is the kind of prized fruit that you like to buy at the fruit stand. Perfect. You go up to northern Pennsylvania between here and Erie at the proper seasons, you can see the fruit trees heavy with fruit. The farmers have tubifores or boards, planks, bracing up the limbs of the trees so that they won't break with their load of perfect fruit and can ripen on the tree. That's done by pruning. Now, pruning is a painful thing. You see, if the tree had feelings, it would protest at such mistreatment from somebody that they're enriching by giving them all this produce. But this is what we do. They have to be pruned. Now, pruning is the secret of life. We're going to come back to pruning. It's the secret of the spiritual life, too. And this is what discipline does. It's a pruning back of our desires. It's not a destruction of our desires. It's a regulation of our desires, a control of our desires. It's a harnessing of our desires, a pruning of our desires. And, of course, if you've seen a well-pruned tree, especially the example that Jesus gives us, vines, if you see a well-pruned vine, it almost looks almost as if it were destroyed or all about destroyed. So deep is the pruning done. To renew it, it would simply die if it weren't pruned, but it's renewed that way. So keep these images in mind. You're thinking in terms of the education of the young, that any restriction or restrictiveness or discipline is contrary to their welfare. It's a suppression of their talents. Their talents will be all the better if they're pruned and disciplined. How many of you admire the work of modern painters? The undisciplined work of many modern painters, they call them, splashing paint all around. They're not admired like the great masters are admired. They go through a fad, and they end up where they ought to end. They're usually, you find them in hotel rooms or the lobbies of hotels or bus stations or that sort of thing. A neutral, non-offensive sort of thing that gives a splash of color over there, but you wouldn't look at them twice to see what they are. So much what passes for art is just that, because it's completely undisciplined art. It doesn't say anything to the human intelligence, to the human mind. Well, now so much for this. So that even though we affirm the harmony between nature and grace in this area, why, there is still this tension, at least. And now we'll take up the point of conflict. There is also a conflict. That's the second term of this relationship. There is also an actual conflict between nature and grace, and we are prone to deny that, and even scholars are prone to deny that. They keep emphasizing how God has created nature and how it is in accord with the impulses of grace, but there is a conflict between nature and grace. And that's what we wish to examine now. The evidence of that conflict we'll find in the Gospel and in the Scripture in St. Paul. The most dramatic statement of it, perhaps, at least that I know of, is in the letter to the Galatians. Incidentally, a very good statement of it is in The Imitation of Christ. Sometimes we read it at the retreats. I don't know whether we'll have a chance to do that. The different movements of nature and grace. If you have The Imitation of Christ, why, you might take it out and read it. I'll make some of them available to you at the end of the retreat if you don't have a copy of it. I recommend you have a copy on your shelf. That's a classic. And that's one of the great, beautiful chapters, the divers or the different motions of nature and grace. But here's one right from the Scriptures. Chapter 5, starting at verse 16. My point is that you should live in accord with the Spirit, and you will not yield to the desires or the cravings of the flesh. You see, the cravings of the flesh, the desires of the Spirit, and the desires. We'll see here there's two sets of desires. The flesh lusts, there's that word, lusts against the Spirit. Now the word lust here doesn't mean sexual lust. We identify lust with sex, but actually lust means any strong desire. We speak, therefore, of the lust for power. The lust for money lust. So it's any strong desire. It's just simply desire which intensifies desire. Desire can get out of hand. Desire can start like a simple breeze, like the wind starts with a simple breeze. But the wind can become a cyclone, a typhoon, a hurricane, destructive. It's not just a gentle breeze on the forehead, you know, or to make our windmills go. It can be either. So the desires are like that. Like we said last evening, sex is just creative or destructive. It's a force that can be used by us in any way that we want. And this is true of all the desires. And here St. Paul, and he's following Jesus exactly, is locating desire, locating the conflict in our desires, our cravings. You will not yield to the cravings of the flesh. And then he says, the flesh lusts against the Spirit. It lusts. See, there's a warfare between the flesh and the Spirit. A conflict. The flesh lusts against the Spirit. And that, now here's the interesting thing too. The Spirit lusts against the flesh. He takes it from both sides. For these two, he says, are opposed each to the other. Now, anyone who would deny then that there's a conflict is against St. Paul. Well, St. Paul is not a very popular author today because of his clear-cut ideas and convictions on it. Anything that wants that makes us discipline our natural desires is unpopular. We want freedom to do whatever we want, when we want, however we want. This is what the human race claims. And it's finding it pretty well now, but with terrible results. So the two are directly opposed. Now, you see, put that down and think about that. That's a basic principle of action that we need to have in our minds and in our thoughts to decide. We can compare the desires, as I gave a good comparison, the winds. The wind. The wind can blow the sailors to home, to a harbor, to prosperity, to their family. The wind can carry the sailors to destruction. They come a cyclone or a typhoon. The winds are neutral, morally, but they can do either. And this is the way St. Paul is telling us that the desires are. We can desire to be a saint. That's a good desire. That's a desire according to the Spirit. And as being according to the Spirit, it's contrary to the flesh, contrary to the desires of the flesh. We can desire to make a million, and that's the desire of the flesh, and it's contrary to the Spirit, or likely to be contrary to the Spirit. As one observer said, few millionaires have made their millions innocently. So, seeking these things is likely to be contrary to the desires of the Spirit. So, this is the opposition that St. Paul finds. And then he goes on. If you are desired by the, if it is obvious what proceeds from the flesh. And then he gives a litany of all the things that proceed from the flesh. It's quite a list. Lewd conduct, impurity, licentiousness, jealousy, drunkenness, envy, orgies, and all the like. All that. All the evils that we do come from our desires. From an innocent beginning, perhaps. But the wind, the breeze becomes the typhoon and is destructive. I warn you that those who do these things, prompted by their desires, will not inherit the kingdom of heaven. In contrast, the lust of the Spirit, the desires of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, endurance, kindness, generosity, faith, mildness, and chastity. All these are the fruits of the Spirit warring against the flesh. So there is a struggle between the flesh and the Spirit, despite the fact that nature and the body are good. We can say in the substantive order, they are good and created by God, but in the practical order, they can get out of hand, namely nature and our natural activity and our natural desires. And it's the business of the Christian life. It's even the business of a human life, but all the more drastically is it the business of the Christian life to keep these desires under harness and to prune them and to gentle them so that they serve the Spirit and that we direct our desires to the good thing, to those fruits down below, peace. Notice that peace is a fruit of the Spirit of God. This, I think, is something that's missed by many pacifists. It's not the result of political action. In our context, peace belongs to the kingdom of God, and it's a fruit of the Spirit of God, and it comes through the action of Spirit in our midst. And therefore, in order to have true peace, and to be really a Christian pacifist, we must live according to the Spirit. And then we can seek these gifts. But the politicians and the diplomats, no matter how skilled they are, have been unable to do it for 2,000 years, and they're still unable to do it today. Reason is helpless against the passions and the pride of man. So there is the text. That's a key text. Now, I know you want one from Jesus. And we had one two or three Sundays ago in the Gospel, in which Jesus locates the origins of sin also in the desires. You'll find it in St. Mark chapter 7. The Jews, that is the Pharisees, the leaders of the Jews, criticized the apostles because they washed their hands before eating. They carried out certain, or the Pharisees washed their hands, but the disciples, the apostles, dispensed themselves from this. And he says, St. Mark comments, the Pharisees and in fact all Jews cling to the custom of their ancestors, and they never eat without scrupulously washing their hands. Now, this was a ritual washing. It wasn't just to clean their hands. I guess we could applaud that. They never eat anything from the market without first sprinkling it. There are many with holy water. That's not a hygienic sprinkling, but a religious sprinkling. There are many traditions they observe. For example, the washing of cups and jugs and kettles. In other words, they put all their religion in this care of external things and care of eternal utensils. They have more than many other traditions they observe. And so, he went on to criticize them. You can read the whole passage there. That's right from the beginning. When he got home from the crowd, the disciples questioned him about this. And he said to them, "You see, are you too incapable of understanding? Do you have a pagan mentality too? You still have a pagan mentality. Can't you understand what I'm talking about? After being with me all this time, don't you see that nothing that enters a man from the outside can make him impure, morally or spiritually? A physical thing, a material thing, can't make you morally or spiritually impure. It does not penetrate his being. It enters the stomach and passes into the latrine." He follows it out clinically. And then he went on.